because I'm leaving Denmark out of it, the UK and Ireland, is bound to exert considerable influence in other regions. In other words, one may see a sort of ripple effect or even trickling effect far beyond Europe. Now, this raises important questions. How is this happening? How are laws and practice in refugee protection regime migrating? Where to are they migrating to? What happens to them once in their new environment? And you'll hear more about this in the next presentation. And why is this happening? So I will address three points this morning. First, the theoretical issues. How do we go about studying the worldwide emulation of Europe? The second point will be more about the norms of selection. How do we select which norms to look at? And finally, I will look at the general findings of our collaborative project, the what, the how, and the why. Now, because of time constraints, I will go through each of these points quite quickly. These are, of course, more developed in the paper, which we were asked to submit before today, and of course, in the book, if any of you is interested in much more details. So starting first with the theoretical issues and the conceptual framework, how do we go about studying the worldwide emulation of Europe? Well, there's a very large body of literature on the possible global influence of the European Union, both in the sociolegal literature on the diffusion of law and in the area of political science and political sociology of the European Union. But what I'm more interested in is the literature in international relations. So what international relations scholars have had to say about the worldwide emulation. And they have been working on diffusion theories for many years. They have noted in particular that worldwide societies tend to organize themselves in a very similar way. Delphine Perrin this morning talked about consensus mondial. Now, this is a puzzle because there are great differences in local conditions and local requirements, such as legal context. Cultures are all different depending in regions, even in countries. And here, there is a particular school of international relations which is particularly helpful in understanding this puzzle, and it is called constructivism. Constructivists seek to explain how ideas spread across borders and take effect in national policy communities. Constructivists basically see a world that is substantially shaped and, well, shaped by the identities of actors and ideas they hold about how they should organize themselves and how they should act. What is interesting is that both constructivists and sociolegal scholars emphasize the role of local actors as mediators in the process of diffusion. So, drawing on this literature, we have examined why a non-EU state would look at the European Union, or indeed elsewhere, for ideas relating to asylum law. There are two main drivers. So coming out of this literature, we've identified two main drivers behind the spread of norms. The first driver is new challenges and uncertainty. Basically, where states are faced with new challenges and are uncertain about how to tackle them, they go and fish for ideas. For instance, I'll just give you a quick example here. Australia, Canada, and Latin America all have found the challenges of coping with increased numbers of mixed flow of refugees, be they from Africa, Asia, or the Czech Republic, to be the principal reasons for looking at the European Union. The second driver for emulation is more normative and stems from formal arrangements, for instance, bilateral agreements with the EU. And Vincent Chetaille wrote the chapter dealing with these kind of more formal arrangements behind the spread of norms. And this was found to be particularly at work in both the case of Israel and Switzerland through the bilateral Dublin Association Agreement between the EU and Israel and Switzerland. Now, state emulation is also a process of diffusion of ideas, of norms. How ideas travel and end being emulated. Now, here again, the literature on constructivism is quite helpful because it points to three facilitating factors. First is the fit. By fit, I mean compatibility. The fit between the foreign norm and the local requirements. Politics, laws, culture, language. In other words, the context, what we generally understand to mean the context, similar legal systems, similar language. The second facilitating factor is the transmitter. And that is the presence and role of transnational policy, legal and advocacy networks in transmitting that foreign norm in the local requirements, the local context. And UNHCR, of course, has played a key role in that. And finally, the third facilitating factor is the role of advocacy groups and other local stakeholders, for instance, local NGOs, but also courts, academics, judges, etc. Their role is often essential, if not crucial, in pushing for normative change from within the country in question. So I now move on to my second point, which is how do we select which norms to look at when studying emulation? Well, it is notoriously difficult to trace the precise origin of a legislative rule. And to overcome this difficulty, one may instead concentrate on trends or patterns relating to law. For instance, a set of restrictive or liberal rules, practices, ideas, as opposed to specific rules. Now, what I've concentrated on was the rules forming the common and European asylum systems. These originated over 20 years ago in state practice and asylum policies. And they are now squarely identified and codified in the CAS. Now, some of these are clearly positive. For instance, the codification of subsidiary protection and temporary protection. These could be argued are positive. Others, on the other hand, are much more restrictive. A tendency towards more exceptions and derogations to the established rules. Restrictive access to international protection through delocalized migration control, the Dublin rule, the Aznar rule, increased securitization, etc. Now, there's a further prediction, which is that other norms likely to spread worldwide are those which the Court of Justice of the European Union has ruled upon, particularly where the rules concerned enshrine a provision of the Refugee Convention, the international treaty. These rules or rulings from the Court of Justice of the EU will carry enormous weight in generally influencing the interpretation of the Refugee Convention worldwide. That is, in promoting an interpretation of what is normal interpretation in 28 countries of the 144 countries which are signatories to the Refugee Convention. So moving on to the general findings. Our study concluded that the EU protection regime is evolving and having a worldwide effect, both through formal international processes, think the bilateral Dublin Association Agreement between the EU and Israel and Switzerland, but also and crucially through informal transnational processes involving various international and local actors and networks. The strength of the evidence varies between countries, but there was clearly, and there is clearly, a broad trend of European restrictive practices that is clearly identifiable in the law and practice of countries and regions outside Europe. And I give you a couple of examples. Accelerated status determinations procedures, as used in the EU, have recently been adopted in Colombia, Ecuador, Panama, and Venezuela as a form of admissibility screening. Now, the pushing factor came from the new challenges raised by the dramatic increase in the number of Colombian refugees and irregular migrants from Africa and Asia. It was facilitated by the compatibility between Latin America and the Spanish legal system, as well as similar languages, which has made Spain, an EU member since 1996, a direct source of inspiration in Latin America. The UNHCR, in particular UNHCR doctrine, also played an important role following UNHCR expanding presence and role in the region. In Australia, EU law and practice on subsidiary protection seems to have had an enormous influence on the codification of complementary protection. European influence could also be discerned with respect to the safe third country concept, which has been borrowed in Australia. Actors involved in this process, process of diffusion and emulation, included the domestic courts, the Department of Immigration, which was, is to be expected, but also, interestingly, submissions by the non-governmental organizations, NGOs, submissions by UNHCR, academics, before Parliament, as well as personal interaction by ministers during travel abroad. Parliamentary debate further show the desire to legitimize any such emulation as part of a growing international consensus, i.e. they claim this is becoming international best practice. Similar examples were found in Canada, Israel, Switzerland, and Africa. And even recently in the United States. In all these instances, the role of UNHCR as a transmitter was found to be particularly important. Finally, in all the countries or regions considered, domestic courts, local NGOs, academics, judges were identified as playing a crucial role in facilitating emulations of norms, particularly during the development of legislation and policy. Yet, what is interesting is that it is the same domestic context or local requirements that were found to be the cause or to cause states to resist the influence of EU law and practice. So they're kind of playing a dual role there. An example is in Australia, where the local conditions, including the absence of a Bill of Rights or anything akin to the European Convention on Human Rights means that emulation of EU norms can only be partial. Another example is in Latin America, where European accelerated procedures are used, but as a means of screening admissibility for refugee status. So as a pre-admissibility phase, whereas in Europe, they are part of the admissibility procedure. In other words, the project was interested in how legal norms are transformed in a constant interplay between domestic, sub-regional, and regional forces, rather than simply being replicated from one region to another. These findings beg the final question: why is the EU such a source of inspiration? What the empirical evidence gathered so far suggests is that EU's normative power is clearly at work in the emulation of European norms of refugee protection. The long-standing commitments of the EU to peace, liberty, democracy, the rule of law, human rights, and its aspiration to social solidarity, anti-discrimination, sustainable developments, and good governments are providing the EU with a broad normative basis. In European refugee law more specifically, this normative basis is anchored in the 1951 Refugee Convention, but also the European Convention on Human Rights, and now the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights, as well as other human rights treaties and customary international law, as we heard this morning. It is also strengthened with a set of supranational institutions competent to legislate on refugee law and interpret provisions of refugee law. With this basis, the EU is able to define what passes for normal in refugee law and international protection. Now, there are problems associated with this exercise in normality, and this will be my conclusion. The rules that are specific to the Common European Asylum System, such as the ASNA protocol and the rules on inclusion and exclusions in the EU qualification directives, are creating a refugee identity that is narrower in its scope than the 1951 Convention, in that it only applies to third country nationals from non-safe countries. Insofar as these norms have already and are likely to continue to spread beyond Europe, they will impact on the construction of refugee identity in other parts of the world. This has obvious implications for the 1951 Refugee Convention, which defines an international status for refugees. As these trends, patterns, and rules grow in influence across the world, European norms may compete with international rules on refugee status. Another risk, which is the end of the slides here, in this emulation, is that whereas the EU has a safety mechanism in place, namely the European Convention on Human Rights, many other countries do not. No matter how restrictive the law might be in Europe, its application in practice is subject to a double judicial check that is unique to Europe, one by the Court of Justice of the EU and the other by the European Court of Human Rights. Furthermore, EU norms are constantly evolving. You've heard about the recast directives, etc. And many of them are becoming more liberal under the influence of this double check. This is true of EU asylum legislation, which continues to be revised, and both courts play a key role in the enhancement of the standards set in the legislation. There is a danger of non-EU countries emulating some of Europe's beliefs, restrictive rules, practices, and ideas without the more liberal interpretation package that comes with it in the European context. States that emulate European refugee law may lack such normative self-correcting mechanism, and I've mentioned Australia earlier, and thus emulation may result in more restrictive versions of European rules being locked in foreign jurisdictions. Thank you.